Welcome to another episode of the Sports Mecca Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Abramo. As always, I'm joined by my partner, Sam Hengeli. For the second time, we have the opportunity to speak with former college basketball coach and current ESPN and Sirius XM radio analyst and broadcaster, Chris Spatola. Chris, Sam and I really appreciate the time once again.
It's my pleasure, guys. Always good to chat with you.
Yeah, absolutely. To start this second edition of the episode with you, just update us on what your summer has been like. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't you like recently spend time at the 25th anniversary of the V Foundation's like a wine celebration gala?
I did, yeah. That was this past weekend. Yeah, it was an incredible event. I had gone to the wine celebration for a number of years, about a decade ago, and then it had been some time since I had been back. So I wanted to get back out there and kind of see what that event had evolved into. And it's actually, to be honest with you, it if not the biggest fundraiser for the V Foundation, it's one of its biggest fundraisers, and it was the 25th anniversary, so I wanted to be there for that. And they asked me to kind of kick off and introduce a video on Jimmy V. So it was, yeah, it was cool. It was they raised like $21 million, which is if at their gala auction on Saturday, which is a remarkable number. So yeah, been doing that, did that, we run our basketball camps. My wife and I run a basketball camp here locally together. That we have a lot of fun with. So it's and with my kids, we went on a couple week vacation to Europe, and we're at the beach now. So it's my kids are at an age where I want to be here for these summers. So it's we've had a blast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you think the basketball camps have been since you've been hosting them?
You know, I appreciate you asking that. They're good. You know, So I ran Coach K's camp for about 10 years, and for every session of that camp, we would get about 700 kids. And so we'd get, by the end of the summer, we'd get about 2,100 kids because we did 3 weeks of the camp with 700 kids a week. And, you know, again, that was great. It becomes a bit of a factory, and you lose a little bit of intimacy, and you lose a little bit of that personal touch when you grow that big. So we wanted to, you know, my wife and I wanted to make an impact. We love working with young people, and we wanted to make an impact, but we wanted to do it in more of a boutique way, because we thought we could kind of address some of the things we see with how youth sports and how young people are taught. We thought we could address it more effectively locally and then intimately. And so it's become a really, really nice little thing that we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, really.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Shifting our focus towards your background, you came on the first time and we had a real deep discussion about the current state of the college basketball season. We did that for the 2022 season. We got some content, some questions that relate to you personally, just about, you know, how you got here to where you are now. So you played college basketball at Army in West Point from 99 to 2002. Talk to us about the challenges that you had, you know, serving while also playing basketball at a high level.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's, there's obviously a lot going on at West Point. So it's, you know, I think at least most of the athletes that I cover at the highest levels of college basketball, you know, I think most of them would certainly make the case that basketball is their first priority. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, that's kind of where we are now. At West Point, you didn't really have an option. Like your academics had to be a priority. The military component to it had to be a priority. and then the sport you played. And so that is going to bring with it inherent challenges to being an athlete. And they're not challenges that can't be dealt with or can't be managed, but it's a different world trying to play a sport at a service academy than I think it would be anywhere else. And it's one that made me better. It's one that that I look back on and appreciate. But at the time, man, it's a different world trying to be a D1 athlete at a service academy.
Right. He wasn't a basketball player, but we had recently a football player named Brad Roberts, who was a running back for Air Force. And he talked about the challenges and the really uniqueness about being an athlete at that school. Like, he had to have no facial hair. He had to have like a certain time that he had to report. And that's just different than most Division I athletes. But, you know, you actually had in your junior and senior seasons, you had like very good numbers. You averaged like 16 points in your junior year, senior year, and then 18 in your junior year. I am interested, like, when you had those numbers, like, did you ever have the thought of, you know, after serving, you know, playing professionally or doing, you know, trying to spend some time at the potential overseas level?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly had aspirations to do that. It kind of quickly went out the window, you know, when 9/11 happened. I mean, my senior year was 9/11. And so my service time, my 5 years, as you mentioned, they were going to be really intensive. And I think I could have certainly played in Europe if I had played right after I graduated, but that just wasn't in the cards. You know, I had to go do my military service time, and it was there just wasn't any time to continue to play basketball. And so the idea of playing professionally after my 5 years, it just wasn't in the cards. And I was okay with that. You know, I learned to move on and, you know, fortunately got the chance, cause Coach K hired me, got the chance to stay in the game and be around the game. And I probably had a brighter future as either a coach or, you know, now a broadcaster. I wasn't even sniffing broadcasting at the time, but I certainly had, I think, a better future or a brighter future as a coach or doing what I'm doing now than necessarily trying to be a player. You guys have seen me. I'm not much to look at. Mm-hmm. So it all worked out, man. It just wasn't in the cards, unfortunately. And I had to hang it up when I did after my last game.
So you mentioned you had to work under Mike Krzyzewski as an assistant coach at Duke from 2007 to 2012. You know, talk to us about how that opportunity really came about in your life.
Well, I had a relationship with Coach for a long time. I had been a camper at his camp, his basketball camp, when I was in high school. My dad was he was my high school coach, and he was a big fan of Coach K, you know, as most coaches were in the early mid-90s. And so we would drive down from the Northeast every summer. And my dad would work the camp, and my brother and I would go to the camp. And I was one of the better players at the camp. And so Coach K kind of knew who I was. And then I ended up, you know, having a friendship with his youngest daughter and ultimately married her. So I knew Coach K on a number of different levels. And when I was thinking about what I was going to do after I got out of the service, I got lucky. You know, it wasn't a given that he was going to hire me. He had a GA spot that actually opened on his staff, and he hired me to be a grad assistant. And then I ultimately, because of staff movement, became the director of operations. And I worked for him for 5 years. It was incredible. I mean, it was just an incredible 5 years that I still lean back on a lot when I'm doing games now.
Mm-hmm. So you actually spent like 1 year after your time as a player at Army, you were an assistant alumni mentor. Like, did that have like connection to what you eventually did at Duke?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it's an interesting question. I kind of glossed over it. So I did, when I graduated, they have a program at West Point where the captain of a team will stay at West Point and be a grad assistant for their, you know, their sports team. And so I actually did, before I went into the active army, I was in the active army. I was still a lieutenant, but I was able to spend, turned out only being 6 months. Normally they let you stay about a year to do the grad assistant spot. But because the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan had just fired up, they actually, after 6 months, said, okay, we're going to need you to come do military stuff now. But yeah, it was cool. I got my coach, who coached me at Army, was actually fired my senior year. And so I got to be a grad assistant for a gentleman named Jim Cruz, who was a really good college basketball coach. So I got to kind of see the game in a different way. So yeah, I spent 6 months as a GA at Army before I went into the active Army.
Mm-hmm. Before we transition into questions related to the sport of college basketball and just college athletics, you know, we got to touch on just the fact that you are Coach K's son-in-law. Were you his son-in-law, like, while you were his assistant coach?
I was his son-in-law when I was when I proposed to my wife when I was in college still. I've known my wife since, you know, she was 14 years old and I was 16 years old. I mean, I've known her the majority of my life, like I've known Coach the majority of my life. So, you know, he's like a second father to me, and in more ways than just being his son-in-law. You know, I don't necessarily talk about that relationship as much, just because I've known him for so long and he's meant so much more to me than just being a father-in-law. But yeah, I worked for him and was married to Jamie, and he couldn't have been a better boss. You know, he could not have been a better boss. And I think one of the reasons he was a great boss is we kept it professional. You know, our familial relationship never crept into what it is we were trying to do within his program. And then he was the same when I started doing TV. I mean, I had to, you know, there were times where either I was calling a Duke game or having to comment on Duke. And, you know, most of the time it's glowing because he's a great coach and that's a great program. But there's sometimes you have to be critical of what you see. And every time I did that, he never, you know, he never said anything to me or had a problem with it. So he was able to keep it professional there as well. So he's a tremendous man.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure that was tough, like, whether it's like before the season or maybe like an interview that you have to have Coach K, you have to conduct with him. And then you still have that relationship that, like, he's your father-in-law. It sounds just like very difficult to really, you know, keep it professional.
Yeah. I think there's a couple things. First of all, again, I knew him before I knew his daughter. I mean, I knew Coach K because we went down to his camp 3 years and I met her the final year we went. I knew Coach, you know, the first year we went there. So I knew him in that way. He helped me even before I was dating Jamie. He helped, you know, my process in getting to West Point and sort of coaching me in that whole process. And then, you know, look, I am a capable person. So it wasn't like he was doing any favors. I think I earned my keep, you know, all along the way. You know, I've never seen him as a father-in-law first. I just haven't, you know, and I don't know. I don't think you guys are married, but eventually you will be and you'll have a father-in-law. And, you know, I think men have varying relationships with their fathers-in-law. So I, you know, it's not something, again, that I've put up as number one when it comes to our relationship. It is, I wouldn't trade it for the world. He's been an amazing father-in-law. He's an amazing father, first and foremost, which is what matters the most to me when it comes to my wife. But beyond that, man, he and I have shared much, much more than son-in-law, father-in-law moments.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
So, being an athlete, member of the armed forces, and a coach, what does true leadership look like to you?
Care for others, responsibility to others, trustworthiness, soldiers eat first was always an expression that that we used in the military, and it's, you know, it's always a watchword for me when it comes to leadership. It's interesting, guys. I walked into my first unit as a young lieutenant, thought I was going to conquer the world, and my battery commander, he pulls me in the office. He says, "I want you to know one thing about leadership. The first thing you need to understand about leadership is it is about them." And he was referring to the soldiers. He said, "You have to do everything in your power to do what's in their best interest. It is never about you." And I think I took that from, again, day one in my unit, and I tried to put it into practice. So I think sometimes we see leadership now, not we, but I think it can be confused with being about the leader. And when you're truly leading, and when you are truly bought into leadership, it's an understanding that it's about others.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this fall, I'm actually going to be coaching cross country, my first like assistant coaching job. I want to know what qualities and skills does it take to be a strong assistant coach in any sport at any level?
Well, it's a great question. And I think that the first thing you need to understand is that they hired you for a reason. They hired you because they think you're capable, that you have smart things to say, and that they want your counsel. I think a lot of times assistant coaches can get into this idea of telling the head coach what they think the head coach wants to hear. You're not doing your job if that's how you handle it. You need to be direct. Sometimes feedback can be positive. Hey, yeah, I think what we did there was awesome. I think what you did there in that moment was great. Or, hey, have you looked at it this way? Or I think, you know, we could probably use this. You know, that back and forth is important, and it's, you know, you're doing your job in that way. And then the other thing is, you have to be a translator as an assistant coach. You have to translate what the head coach wants in a palatable way for players. And you have to have a sense of what's getting to the players, what they are internalizing and what they're not. And I think it's an assistant's job to sort of balance tone and message and, you know, help the head coach, you know, again, internalize that message in players as best as possible. So it's a privilege to be an assistant. It really is, because you have a very, very important role. And that's awesome to hear, Sam. That's awesome. Yeah. You're going to do that.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And I appreciate some of the advice there with that question. So I want to talk about one guy you competed against, and then a guy that you've gotten to broadcast games and gotten to interview, who had a complete downfall this offseason, and Bob Huggins. What are your thoughts on Bob Huggins, and how should college basketball fans remember him?
Yeah, they should remember him as a Hall of Famer. I'll answer the second part first, because he is. He is absolutely a Hall of Famer. His contributions to the game of basketball, first and foremost, will go down historically. The impact he had on really every player who he coached was immeasurable. You know, the loyalty and the love that his players have for him still is, I think, speaks, you know, it speaks volumes. So he was one of the greats in our game. There's no doubt about it. You know, look, I think when you do something as long as Coach Huggins did it, I think the end is probably not going to be as clean as we, who aren't feeling what he's feeling and didn't live that life in his shoes, then we would want it to be for him. Mm-hmm. You know, I said the same thing after Coach Boeheim. You know, it was an awkward way to step down from Syracuse, the way mm-hmm. he did it after that ACC tournament game. But, you know, look, I say the same thing about a Brett Favre, went through six different retirements, or I say the same thing about a Tom Brady who decides he wants to come back. I said the same thing about Coach K and his farewell tour. I wasn't a fan of it. But look, you know, Derek Jeter, Coach K, they want to go out with a farewell tour. Like, I am of the belief that the end of a great career is not an easy thing. I don't know that, but I can assume that. And so I wish Coach Huggins had been advised better at the end here, I wish somebody had stepped in and said, it's time to go. You know, I wish somebody had stepped in and sort of coached him there, but I won't fault him. I think that part will be forgotten. And ultimately I think the name Bob Huggins will go down historically for the coach that he was.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll miss watching Coach Huggins on the sidelines, and then his great mentorship to obviously his players, and what he did for the game of college basketball was significant, and we'll miss him a lot.
Yes, we will. There's no doubt about that.
So one of the biggest issues plaguing colleges, college athletics, and probably I would say colleges in general has been hazing. We saw a college basketball team cancel the remainder of their season with New Mexico State due to hazing. And then the recent fallout in Northwestern's football program and then their baseball program got exposed, which caused Patch Fitzgerald to lose his job. What are your thoughts on those situations?
Yeah, I think hazing, and I speak from a position of experience. I mean, I was hazed at West Point. Hazing was a big part of that culture. Hazing was a big part of military service. You know, I mean, hazing was fundamental to that organization for a long, long time. There's a reason that organization has done away with it. Hazing no longer flies at West Point anymore. And if hazing's not flying in the military, hazing shouldn't be flying anywhere. I think hazing is a sign of tremendous insecurity. I think it is, it's a misunderstanding of how veterans should impart wisdom on younger people. And I think sometimes we as veterans, our insecurities can get a hold of us. And there's this idea that, well, we're going to make whomever, younger people have to earn something, rather than treating them with the respect and the dignity that they deserve. So that's how I feel about hazing. I don't think it has any place in any organization, and certainly not a form of leadership. I also think that the way that Northwestern handled it was atrocious, and was, again, counter to what it means to be a good leader. They were not out front about it. If they didn't know about it, they're negligent. If they did, obviously they're negligent. So, you know, two strikes there on that one. So look, I think at the end of the day, attitude is a reflection of leadership, to borrow the line from Remember the Titans. And if hazing is going on within programs, it is in part a reflection of leadership. And it's certainly a reflection of the leadership of those veterans in that program, but it's certainly a reflection of Pat Fitzgerald and the athletic department there at Northwestern.
As a college coach, how would you address a hazing at the start of the year when they get onto campus? How would you like address that issue so you can prevent it from happening?
Well, I would echo some of the things I just said. I would also, there's a zero tolerance for it. See, here's the other thing about hazing. Hazing is more than just one or two people. Hazing is everybody who's complicit. Now, in the case of Northwestern, folks who were hazed did come forward. But if there are players in that locker room who may not have been actively hazing, but were aware of it or were there while it was going on and didn't say anything, you are now complicit. Acceptance is, you know, as just as you are just as culpable as people who are actually doing it. And so I think expressing that to a team is important. And then explaining what leadership actually looks like. I mean, the thing is, guys, young people, and I use that term generally, like I still look at college athletes as in a fundamental stage of their life. They got to understand and be taught what right looks like. And there are some of them who, you know, maybe they came up through a program that had hazing and then were led to believe that was the way you impart wisdom and you lead. And sometimes people have to be told that's not how leadership is done. And so, you know, again, I think showing what right looks like, explaining how leadership is best practiced is also very important.
So good. So good. Love that. How do you promote good team camaraderie without harming others?
Well, what do you mean by harming others?
I meant like hate without like maybe doing like the hazing and
Well, I mean, shared experiences, you know, is one of those things. You know, look, accountability is fundamental to any organization. And accountability is not retroactive. Accountability is set from the beginning. The terms are set, and they're set with this thing we call standards. Mm-hmm. And it is a big part of leadership's responsibility to A, make those standards known from the beginning, and then ultimately hold members of that organization to the standard. If you don't meet the standard, there will be consequences. Consequences and accountability go hand in hand. And so it starts with accountability and how accountability is employed. And, you know, and then again, it's you know, coaching your veterans. You know, the best teams I've been a part of were player run teams, player led teams, where your veteran players or your veteran soldiers are coaching the younger folks. And so, you know, explaining that part of a culture is important as well. But it starts with accountability, Sam. And if you don't have accountability within an organization and an adherence to a standard, then you're going to be directionless.
Right. Never let the little things slide. Never let the small things slide. I want to talk about a lot has happened in college athletics. Conference realignment, once again, a big conversation, and has changed college sports dramatically. The Big 12 will gain Colorado, Utah, Arizona, Arizona State. What are your thoughts on conference realignment, and how does this affect college basketball?
Yeah, I'll say two things on realignment first. You know, when you live in a hyper-capitalist environment, and that's what college athletics has become, it is hyper-capitalist. Growth is the only goal. Getting bigger and bigger and bigger is the only goal. And I don't have a problem with growth until it comes at the expense of values. It comes at the expense of intimacy. It comes at the expense of tradition. And I think what we have failed to understand is that sometimes you can make decisions in the short term that harm you in the long term. And I think we have become so hyper-capitalist in college athletics that we have lost sight of what the organization, what those traditions, those rivalry, what those things have meant. And look, it's not going to have maybe a discernible effect, but it's death by a thousand paper cuts. And I think that's what we are engaging in right now in college athletics. There is a diminishing impact that we are seeing on the product that may not be seen tomorrow, may not be seen 2 weeks from now, but it will be seen at some point. That we have grown so hyper-capitalist and that growth has become the only goal. And then the second thing I'll say is I think so much of this is motivated by certainly money. I think the other thing that is motivating this is ambition. I think we have a lot of athletic directors and presidents of these universities and commissioners who are ambitious people. You don't get to that point in life if you're not. They are concerned with legacy. They were very fearful right now of, for example, going back to when Texas and Oklahoma left the Big 12 in the dead of night. That was announced at SEC Media Day. You guys remember that was announced at SEC Media Day. That was a very, very cold transaction. That was an ice cold transaction that I think sent shockwaves through leadership in college athletics. And then you have USC and UCLA do it on the sneak. I think we have a lot of people, a lot of leadership in college athletics right now that are really running scared because they don't want to be left out in the cold. They don't want to be that program that's now relegated. And so I think a lot of this is ambitious people who are operating in fear and are making rash decisions in the short term that are going to have a negative impact in the long term. And I think it is certainly driven by growth and money, but I also think it's ego. And let's not forget, these commissioners, ADs, and presidents are human beings, and they suffer a lot of the same insecurities that we all do, except they got a lot on their shoulders. And I think they are mishandling it in this moment as they are all trying to reach the mountaintop.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just unfortunate, like, It just seems really weird. Like, you think about, like, UCLA and USC are going to have to go all the way to New Jersey to go play a conference game. And then, like, obviously same for Washington and Oregon and a bunch of these schools. And then we'll have, like, Arizona go to play UCF. It doesn't seem right at all. I miss the old college athletic days where it's just, like, all regional.
Yeah, well, and I didn't even touch on the hypocrisy of the whole thing. I mean, that point has obviously been made. You know, we're complaining about transfer portal and players movement and all of this, and this is what the leadership, again, you lead by example. Coaching and leadership, these are mentorship positions. And what that means is you have to practice what you preach. Again, soldiers eat first. Like, you can't hold somebody accountable to a certain standard and then over here out of the other side of your mouth, you're doing something else. And so, I mean, to your point, Sam, we didn't even touch on the hypocrisy of all of this and how, you know, again, the double standard that they are trying to operate under and have operated under for a long, long time. The jig is up. And I don't think they quite understand that, or maybe they do and they just don't care anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's move on from the conference realignment talk and then talk about the past college basketball season. What was your favorite game you got to call last year?
Wow. It's a good question, because I never really, it's funny you asked that. I never really look back and, like, say what was the best game. I mean, the year prior, so 2 years ago, I did the Chris Beard's return to Texas Tech. That was an amazing moment because the arena was on fire. I did the first Missouri game, you know, when they resumed that rivalry, the border war, or I guess we're not calling it that anymore. Who knows?
Border what showdown.
Yeah, I guess we'll call it that. Those were cool 2 years ago. You know, the one of the better games I called last year was in Fog Allen. It was West Virginia. I don't know if you guys remember West Virginia taking on Kansas there and came down to the last play. West Virginia had the ball. They didn't even get a shot off because of Kansas's defense in the final 30 seconds of that game. That was a lot of fun. You know, being at the Big 12 tournament is always a blast. I love doing that at the end of the season. So it was a good year. It was a good year last year.
What was it like seeing Fat Joe and Shaq at the Big 12 tournament?
Well, you know what? That's Brett Yormark, man. I mean, he is going to brand the Big 12 as a hipper, younger, more, I think, attractive conference. And that was part of it, you know, making the best basketball product, which the Big 12 is and has been over the last handful of years, you know, making the best basketball league the place to be. And when you bring in Fat Joe and you bring in, you know, Shaq and, you know, those guys, it's and then Jordan Sparks singing the national anthem, like, you make it the place to be and it's going to draw some eyeballs. So it was a great time. It was a party.
Yeah, for sure. Wonder if we'll see if Deion Sanders will come out to the Big 12 tournament when Colorado gets into the Big 12. Maybe he'll make a trip.
Yeah, we'll see.
So one of the things I really love you do on social media, you do a lot of motivational posts. You, like, share, like, whether it's at your camp or you just, like, on another podcast. I would love to hear some advice you would give to those chasing a dream.
Yeah, man, geez. I don't know if I have the answers to that, but I will tell you that you always want to make sure that you are prepared for an opportunity or preparing for an opportunity as opposed to just looking for an opportunity. Because if you're preparing in the right way, Sam, and you're doing the work, you're not skipping steps, you're going through the process of preparing to do whatever it is you want to do, you're going to ultimately get there. And then once you get there, the goal is to stay there. And I think we are living in this space right now where everybody wants to get to the end state super quick. Mm-hmm. And some, you know, maybe sometimes luck intervenes or maybe you have a relationship and that gets you in the door and all of that's great. But if you're not prepared to stay there or prepared to do a good job while you're there, then you're not going to sustain. And so I've lived, you know, I've kind of lived that. When I first got into broadcasting, I was doing, you know, Patriot League games on CBS Sports Network that, you know, maybe 50 people were watching, but they were valuable to me because I was preparing my voice. I was learning how to prepare to do games. I was learning about television so that once I did get my opportunity that at ESPN or get my opportunity to do some bigger games, I was capable and prepared to do a good job. So, I think we're very focused on, you know, ultimately where we want to be, which there's nothing wrong with that, but you got to understand there's this big thing called process between now and then. And it's a very, very valuable part of ultimately getting to where it is you want to be. And so that would be one bit of advice. And then the other is treat people with kindness, you know, because A, you never know what those people are going to end up being or who they are. But the other thing is there's no greater networking advancement tactic than kindness. Everybody's looking for the way to network, and everybody's looking, if you treat everybody you come in contact with kindness, that's going to be the greatest way to advance.
Man, that is awesome. I loved every second of it. And I cannot wait to share this with my team. When I get a chance to coach them, I'm going to bring up a lot of those things that you said, not just what you just said there, but throughout the podcast. And Chris, we really appreciate you coming on, man, and really enjoyed this conversation. And thank you for your service once again. And thank you for taking the time to talk with Steven and I.
It's my pleasure, guys. I always enjoy it. Thanks for asking me to come on.
For those who are listening to our show for the first time, all our past and future episodes are available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Also, make sure to follow us on Instagram and Twitter @TheSportsMecca.